This month, The Spectator becomes the first magazine in history to print 10,000 issues, and we'd like to celebrate with you. Subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of commemorative Spectator gin, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/celebrate.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Audio Reads. It's The Spectator's 10,000th edition, and historian Tom Holland writes about the magazine's winning recipe in this week's issue. Here he is.
The Spectator is a child of the 19th century, and damned proud of it. First published in 1828, the link provided by its 10,000 issues to a long-vanished age of Regency waistlines and romantic poets is one of the great wonders of journalism. Its success was built upon Victorian foundations, yet it is a peculiarity of the current media landscape that The Spectator, the only current affairs magazine actually to have been published in the 19th century, should in many ways seem the least Victorian of the lot. The New Statesman, Prospect, Standpoint, all have a certain quality of moral earnestness that one could imagine Gladstone admiring. The Spectator, by contrast, seems to breathe the coffee-perfumed air of an earlier age. Right from its first edition, it has been shaded by the spectre of a vanished sensibility. In its morals, its values, its style, there is little of the wing collar about it. Dress the Spectator up in period costume, and it would have to sport a powdered wig. The magazine has always cast a certain wistful gaze back at the 18th century. This is evident enough from its title. To launch a new publication back in 1828 was no less a leap of faith than it would be today. But to call it The Spectator was a gesture of self-confidence so lavish that it might have seemed to verge on the conceited. The original Spectator, founded in 1711, was a daily publication which, despite folding after a year, had come to be enshrined over the course of the 18th century as a supreme model of English prose. As David Butterfield describes in his history of the magazine, Joseph Addison and Richard Steele, the men who had written the essays which constituted The Spectator's daily offering, were admired by even the most exacting critics. Whoever wished to attain an English style, familiar but not coarse, and elegant but not ostentatious, must give his days and nights to the study of Addison. This decree, coming from the robustly Tory Dr. Johnson, was praise indeed for a man who had ranked as a most notorious Whig. To call a magazine The Spectator, then, was to follow in the footsteps of giants. But Robert Rintoul, the enterprising Scottish radical who served as its first editor, knew what he was doing. Addison and Steele had given to Mr. Spectator the attributes of a man ideally qualified to provide a newly urban and commercial society with its role model. Interested in the affairs of the day, knowledgeable about literature, art and music, sociable, amusing and amused. Above all, Mr. Spectator affected to eschew the rancorous polarisation that, then as now, was such a characteristic of English society. Both Addison and Steele knew that the medicine of their Whiggery was likely to be swallowed by their readers if sugared with wit. It was a measure of their success that James Boswell, who defined himself throughout his great biography of Dr. Johnson as being, like his hero, a Tory, should consciously have sought to emulate the easy disposition of Mr. Spectator. Indeed, Boswell wrote, "I had accustomed myself so much to laugh at everything that it required time to render my imagination solid." For Rintoul, as it had been for Addison and Steele, the great enemy of journalism was dullness. Today's Spectator, almost 200 years on, still manifestly subscribes to that conviction. It is evident in its patronage of writers who have variously drunk themselves to death, or gone to prison for possession of cocaine, in the surge of sex scandals that, during the editorship of the current Prime Minister, added so hugely to the gaiety of the nation, in its willingness to probe the limits of what liberal opinion in Britain today regards as acceptable, and to do so in a tone of satire that Swift might well have enjoyed. It is evident, too, in its ongoing commitment to the discovery made long ago by Addison and Steele, that a political perspective can most effectively be promoted by sweetening it with variety and lightness of style. Much as Pope, in the original version of the Dunciad, shuddered before the prospect that wit's vain works shall fall, and universal dullness cover all, so does the Spectator today. Small wonder, then, that its blog should be called Coffee House. By the reign of Queen Anne, whose statue, like a tutelary deity, stands just round the corner from the Spectator's office, the Coffee House had come to be dreaded by its enemies as a centre of the most seditious, indecent, and scandalous discourses, and by its defenders as a shrine to polite conversation. To Boswell, who revelled in the opportunities it provided to eavesdrop on conversation and to observe the ways of the world, it constituted a veritable monument to the ideals of Addison and Steele. There was nowhere better, he mused, for a person of imagination and feeling, such as the Spectator finely describes. Sometimes refined, sometimes rambunctious, sometimes learned, sometimes louche, sometimes formal, sometimes frivolous, the Coffee House constituted a shrine to the spirit of journalism. No bad role model, then, for a magazine to have. Even one that can boast of having chalked up 10,000 editions and of ranking as the longest-lived current affairs magazine there has ever been.
That was Tom Holland. And now, Douglas Murray.
I love my fellow hacks, even when I disagree with them. By Douglas Murray. It's one way to keep in touch with people. Each morning, somewhere between the first coffee of the day and the first drink, I open my computer, log on to social media, and see which of my friends or colleagues is trending today. Ooh, I think, as I see their names flash up. I wonder what Julie, Charles, Alison, James, Rod, usually Rod, has done now. Then I click and read all about their crimes, usually through a filter of people labouring under the impression that a writer's job is to say what everyone else has already agreed on. The howls, incidentally, mostly emanating from people who in no sense subscribe to the organ in which the crime is said to have occurred. This is one of the brightest moments of my day, for at these times I feel a huge surge of communal pride. I do not know if it is the same in all professions. I don't know if chartered accountants love other chartered accountants, taxi drivers love other taxi drivers, or actors love anyone other than themselves. But I do love hacks, journos, and opinion mongers. Whether their views are in alignment with my own matters less and less with the years. The fact is that the more I see them attacked, the more grateful I am for this strange, disputatious, disagreeable tribe. Take Peter Hitchens. I have no idea whether Peter is right or wrong in his claim that this country has done the wrong thing in locking itself down to avoid coronavirus. But every time I see him sally forth in print or on screen to argue his case, I thank God for whatever it was in the Hitchens milk that produced such argumentative, unintimidatable sons. Just as the desire to speak up transcends political tribes, so the temptation to shut things down is not confined to any one political side. Recently, I wrote something nice about the Guardian contributor Suzanne Moore, who had done an exceptional thing by publishing something in The Guardian, despite its being true. Yet, after my Moore encomium, a number of otherwise contented readers got in touch to remonstrate. How could I say anything nice about Miss Moore, they asked. Had I not seen what she once said about the male sex, the royal family, or any number of other things? And my answer is the same. I don't agree with anyone on everything, but as I grow older, I am gladder and gladder for people who keep firing off in style, whatever the incoming flak. It was William Nicholson in his film about C.S. Lewis, Shadowlands, who came up with that beautiful line, "We read to know we are not alone." A feeling that approximates to the sensation Aristotle called anagnorisis, the moment of discovery or recognition. Great art regularly hits us with this emotion, the discovery that someone else lived who felt as we have felt. Well, I would propose that a less grandiose, often coarser, but equally significant quality marks out desirable magazine writing. As online readers will know, in recent weeks I have been rereading some of my favourite Spectator columnists of recent decades, and one thing this has clarified is the fact that, for me, the definition of good writing includes something which makes me whistle and think, I am so glad that someone has said that out loud. Sometimes it is on a deep moral issue, like Mary Wakefield writing on abortion. Sometimes it is a matter of artistic judgment, as Lloyd Evans managed in a theatre column in 2015, when he summed up in just four paragraphs everything that is wrong with George Bernard Shaw. Often it is something so embarrassing that you just punch the air with joy that somebody has been willing to write and publish it, such as Cosmo Landesman writing about whether right-wing women are better in bed than left-wing women. Yes. Or Rod writing about his and his wife's calamitous evening of wine criticism. If there isn't all that much solidarity, then perhaps it is in part because we don't get together often enough for the camaraderie to break out in public. Some people would say that is a good thing, and that such disputatious people ought to be kept apart. The Spectator's annual summer party provides some evidence for this line of reasoning. It always starts off respectably enough with politicians, journalists, and even some television presenters networking away happily. But the best part is when the grandees have cleared off, when the last spad or PR man has been led out by the hand like a defeated chimpanzee. Then you'll see the opinionated classes still arguing it out, with nothing to stop them but last orders or oblivion, whichever comes first. Last year, as the crowd thinned, I watched one hack finally collapse backwards into a hedge at the bottom of the garden, without even the hint of a crumple. Ramrod straight they stayed, even as the ground came rushing towards them. I think most people were too busy arguing to notice, but someone else got there first, and a cry went up that temporarily stilled the discussion. Is there a doctor in the garden? During a short pause, it became clear that there was. Then the voice again. Is there a sober doctor in the garden? A couple of years back, the editor had the fine idea of throwing a hacks-only party, so we didn't all have to be on such good behaviour. I think Nick Cohen was still drinking then. Somehow, I recall Jeremy Clarke being carried out more than once, the last time under someone's arms, like a rolled-up carpet. A left-wing feminist definitely me-tooed me. It was a glorious, terrible, messy, disputatious, hilarious battlefield of an evening. We lost some of our best men last night, I said quietly to the deputy editor the next day, but I feel like we made some small advances on the enemy's territory. What are those enemies? Boredom, predictability, obviousness, humourlessness, dullness, staleness, the demand for boring consensus of any kind. Most of all, that gang of people who seem to grow in volume, if not in number, by the year, who cry, "You can't say that." Well, bugger them. Here's to the awkward squad, wherever they fall.
That was Douglas Murray. And now, Mary Wakefield on coronavirus uncertainty.
I had thought that actually getting the coronavirus would bring clarity, that there would be some satisfaction in meeting the enemy, feeling its spectral hands around my lungs. No such luck. Uncertainty is the hallmark of the coronavirus. Even its origins are murky. Wet markets, or the Wuhan Center for Disease Control. Who knows? And who would ever believe the Chinese government now anyway? When you've got it, the sense of medieval unknowing only deepens. Is this definitely it? Will it get worse? Will it come back? My version of the virus began with a nasty headache and a grubby feeling of unease, after which I threw up on the bathroom floor. "That's disgusting, Mum," said my 4-year-old son, handing me a towel with a look of patronising distaste. I've never known a bug treat its victim so differently. My friends have reported stabbing sore throats, a loss of taste and smell, and numbness in their fingertips. A university in Wuhan has just updated its list of official first symptoms, which now includes headache, dizziness, muscle inflammation, fever, diarrhea, vomiting, and coughing. One slight but sad effect of this great variation in symptoms is that it makes phoning friends to share corona stories peculiarly unsatisfying. "Weren't the muscle aches awful?" "Oh, you didn't get them." "Nope, no sore throat for me." "Oh well." That evening, as I lay on the sofa, a happy thought occurred to me. If this was the virus, then my husband, who works 16-hour days as a rule, would have to come home. I let myself imagine a fortnight in bed with mild symptoms, chatting to Dorman's son through an open door. More fool me. My husband did rush home to look after me. He's an extremely kind man, whatever people assume to the contrary. But 24 hours later, he said, "I feel weird," and collapsed. I felt breathless, sometimes achy, but Dom couldn't get out of bed. Day in, day out, for 10 days he lay doggo with a high fever and spasms that made the muscles lump and twitch in his legs. He could breathe, but only in a limited, shallow way. After a week, we reached peak corona uncertainty. Day 6 is a turning point, I was told. That's when you either get better or head for ICU. But was Dom fighting off the bug, or was he heading for a ventilator? Who knew? I sat on his bed, staring at his chest, trying to count his breaths per minute. The little oxygen reader we'd bought on Amazon indicated he should be in hospital. But his lips weren't blue, and he could talk in full sentences such as, "Please stop staring at my chest, sweetheart." "When do you go to hospital? Do you really wait till the lips go blue?" My son, in his doctor's uniform, administered Ribena with the grim insistence of a Broadmoor nurse. And this might be my only really useful advice for other corona parents or single mothers with preschoolers. Get out the doctor's kit. Make it your child's job to take your temperature. Any game that involves lying down is a good game. My other tip is to order at least a litre of glue. As Dom lay sweating, my son and I made a palace out of polystyrene packaging. I've laughed in the past at men who obsess over model railways. I won't laugh again. In a chaotic and unpredictable environment, there's nothing more comforting than having total control over your own tiny world. Long after my son lost interest, I was busy gluing on towers and cutting coloured acetate to make window panes. When Dom finally did make it up and into the kitchen, he found me applying cheap plastic stick-on gems to a loo roll tower. "Mum's busy playing," I heard my son tell Dom as he trotted off to fetch the oxygen meter. Just as Dom was beginning to feel better, it was reported that Boris was heading in the other direction, into hospital. I've been a slack Christian during this era of biblical plague. Churches are shut, even Catholic churches, and somehow that makes more of a difference than I thought it would. One of the reasons I converted was because the doors of Catholic churches were always open, the sanctuary lamp lit. And now they're closed, it feels as if someone's turned off the spiritual stopcock. But what is there to do for the sick now, except pray? I left my polystyrene palace and got to my knees for Boris, and found to my surprise that my prayers flowed easily, as if carried along in a current of others. After the uncertainty of the bug itself, we emerged from quarantine into the almost comical uncertainty of London lockdown. Everything and its opposite seems true. People are frightened, and they're calm. It's spring, and it's not. Queuing's a pain, and the most fun you'll have all day. There's been much talk of the spirit of the Blitz, but there's something of the spirit of East Berlin here in London too. Social distancing is supposed to be a helpful and communal act, but people smile noticeably less. There's a woman jogger I've seen a few times now, who runs around scowling with an arm held out horizontally to keep everyone at bay. If I didn't have a child in tow, I'd be tempted to walk straight into her. But then there are the birds, which are chirpier now there's less noise to compete with, and the strange and wonderful feeling of returning to a world in which waiting is a thing. It's like the 1990s all over again. people leaning on walls, staring into the distance, scuffing their trainers for something to do in the queue. And when you do meet a friend by chance on the street and stop for a guilty distance chat, it feels utterly joyful.
That was Mary Wakefield. And last, Tanya Gold, on what it's like to be The Spectator's restaurant critic.
A fictional Spectator restaurant critic called Forbes McAllister appeared on Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge. He was played by Patrick Marber and was obviously based on Keith Waterhouse, bow tie, mad eyes, even if Waterhouse was never the restaurant critic at this magazine. McAllister was on TV to show off Lord Byron's dueling pistols and a lock of his stupid hair. He bought them to annoy Michael Winner, then restaurant critic at the Sunday Times. "Are you entirely motivated by hatred?" Partridge asked McAllister. It was his best ever question. "Yes, I think I am," said McAllister. "Rather perceptive of you. I hate you." Partridge then shot McAllister with a dueling pistol, and he died. I am proud of that, and there are other privileges to restaurant criticism. I was allowed into Rules just for pudding, after I explained that I had eaten at Morrow in Farringdon and needed golden syrup pudding to recover. I was at Morrow stalking Tony Gallagher, who had just left the editorship of the Daily Telegraph for a job in a kitchen. Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad touched me as I ate in a restaurant on the stage of the National Theatre during Network. I ate in Prince Charles's gazebo at Highgrove when he wasn't there. My mother uses my name to get reservations. Corbin and King, the best restaurateurs in London, the Delaunay, the Woolsey, Fishers, know her game, but they let her get away with it. I have done specialist chip restaurants, specialist lasagna restaurants, specialist cereal restaurants, and too many specialist steak restaurants. The best is Beast, even if it stole its aesthetic from the Saw franchise. The worst food I ever had was in Trump Tower, followed by Pharmacy, spelt with an F, and its plant-based hot chocolate. My greatest regret was my failure to get into the specialist Cadbury's cream egg restaurant. I think about it when I am insomniac. It is rare that I review a restaurant that I think you will not like, or will at least enjoy for its absurdity, although I made an exception for the naked pop-up Bunyadi. I visited because my husband liked the idea of a naked waitress in a fake glade in a former pub in South London. He got a naked bald man from Belgium, raw meat and berries. It is rare that I am insulted, although Keith McNally threw me out of Balthazar in Covent Garden for smoking a vape. I didn't mind. I hated him. Balthazar is like Café Rouge, but worse, and the worse the restaurant, the better the review. It's hard to write well about perfection, and harder to write well about mediocrity. That is how I defend my odder choices. You are not eating the review. You are reading it. I'm not going to force you to go on Viking's River Splash at Legoland. I'm still glad I went to Pedro's Tex-Mex Cantina in Norwich after they were banned from UEA for handing out sombreros. I would love to bring you a review from restaurants that existed in 1828, but I've done them all at least twice, and some three times, Wilton's, Rules, and they are closed for now. Incidentally, Hyde on Piccadilly is doing takeout. Oli Dabu is the best chef of his generation, so his takeout will be singular. If you do, please write to me and tell me how it was. I could have done the Admiral Benbow pub in Chapel Street in Penzance, which was ancient by 1828 and probably full of Spectator readers moaning about France. But there is a full-size papier-mâché pirate on the roof and, considering the gravity of this issue, I didn't feel it had the right sense of occasion.
That was Tanya Gold. Thanks for listening, and remember, you can always let us know what you think about this podcast, as well as who you'd like to hear next at podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and join us again for the next episode.